They've been in Bethlehem. They've already had three different sessions in the schools. Tonight they'll be back at Bethlehem for 5 o'clock at what's his first name? Johnny Shachwan. He'll be there to minister again. If you know anyone in the Bethlehem area, you can alert them to this opportunity and time of blessing to see the minister there. So we'll just invite them to come and give us the word of the Lord. Amen.
It's good to be back. For those who don't know who we are, we travel around the United States for the last 16 years. We started a ministry called Feel the Power, where we break bricks and rip phone books in half and do the feats of strength. And I was raised in a Jewish household. I became a Christian at 16 years old. And then for the last 6 years, we've been coming here to Israel. I made a commitment to come every year, and I've kept that commitment. And so we've been coming here and speaking in the schools here in Jerusalem all over. Last night, we were in Nahariya speaking up there, and we drove all night, got back here. I'm a little tired this morning, but it's good to be here. And I love coming to here to see Chuck and Liz and everybody. Everybody makes us feel such at home. The first time we came here, my wife was actually pregnant. The second time we came here, my daughter was 6 months old. She's 3 and a half now, and she's never spent a Thanksgiving in America. She spent every Thanksgiving here in Israel. It's Chinese food and Tiberias or whatever, you know. And so we live in California. Lowell and Tammy live in Montana. And my daughter actually had her third birthday in South Africa this year. And so, roundabout way. But I'm going to do a feat of strength this morning. Let me get that steel bar. The way we do the feat of strength, not to show people how strong we are. One person said, yeah, they're all tricks. They're all fake. They're all real. Believe me, I have all the pain to show you. And the soreness. And so I'm going to take a steel bar and bend it in half. Let me get a couple of people to help me out real quick. Oh, come up here since you got my shirt on. And my man right there in the red, come on up here. Want to help me out? Do you want to help me out here? No? Okay, let me get one more person to help me out. Let's see. Yeah, Lowell, why don't you come up here on the stage? Coming up here. Lowell is from Montana. He came out here on this trip to help us out. Okay, now we're going to say, give you guys names. What's your name again?
Yedidia.
Okay, that's right. I can't say that. Okay, Yedidia, or you come stand right there. And what's your name?
Sam.
Sam, thank the Lord. Okay, Sam, come stand right there. Okay, what's going to happen is to show everyone this is a real steel bar, you can grab on with both your hands, okay? And I'm going to shoulder press you guys up in the air and spin you around, okay? To show everyone this is real today before I bend it, okay? So you got to hold on really, really tight, okay? You ready?
Yeah.
Are you scared? you should be. Okay, hold on really tight. Pick you up and spin you around. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Give me a countdown, starting with 10.
All right, let's help John by counting down from 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There they go. Those of you in the front row, your job is very important. If they fly off, you need to catch them. There they go. Give them a great big hand, would you?
Hey, give them both a big hand. Thank you so much. I gave him a t-shirt. Sam, you can get a t-shirt in the back too. Afterwards, you can take one as a gift. So thank you so much for helping out. There's t-shirts back there for sale, and whatever you can afford, there's some prices back there. But every t-shirt is sold here this morning. It goes to help feed starving families. Mine. And so I'm going to bend this steel bar. You might see this done on television before. A guy will bend a steel bar behind his neck. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to place it in my teeth. Okay? So give me a countdown. Starting with 10 again.
Now this is 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There we go, ladies and gentlemen. That's a dentist's worst nightmare right there. Right in half. John Pritikin, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. So that's what I do. And we in the United States, we speak to 150,000 students a year, and we go overseas about every 3 months. My favorite place is to come is here. I really enjoy coming here. I like South Africa, by the way, too. And but the reason why we do the Feast of Strength is to grab people's attention. And no matter if last week I was in the United States speaking to – we spoke to 10,000 kids in 3 days and watching young people walk up to us at the end of the assembly and turn in their suicide notes because they're about to commit suicide that day. And they didn't because we were in their school. In the United States, we can't mention God's name at all. But how many people know they can legislate the name of Jesus at every school in America, but you can't legislate his presence? And that's what kids feel. We'll get letters saying, we felt God today, but we didn't mention his name. And so we'll come here, and we were in Bethlehem, right outside the Hope School, and watching those kids as we share and watching them cry. And I love coming here. And it's an honor. I want to share for you just a moment. I realize the only thing between you and a good lunch is us. And so we want to be brief this morning. And I'll never forget that one of the favorite things I get to do is speak in small towns. I love going to small towns, especially in the U.S. Small towns have a couple things in common, and usually they always have a paper, a newspaper that comes out once a week. And they don't come out every day, it comes out once a week, and they have crazy stories in them. There's a story about Chippy the Parakeet. Chippy the Parakeet is sitting in his birdcage one day. He's rocking back and forth, having a great time. And Chippy's owner decides she's going to clean Chippy's birdcage. So she grabs the vacuum cleaner. And she takes the hose of the vacuum cleaner. And she sticks it in the birdcage. And she starts cleaning out the birdcage. She's cleaning out the bird seats and the other stuff at the bottom of a birdcage. And all of a sudden, the phone rings. And what she does with her opposite hand, she grabs the phone. When she does, this hand that's holding the vacuum cleaner, this moves a little bit slightly, and all of a sudden, into the vacuum cleaner goes Chippy. Down the vacuum cleaner, into the vacuum. She realizes what she's done. She turns off the vacuum, she hangs up the phone, and there she opens up the vacuum cleaner, and there's Chippy. He's alive. It's a miracle. From the top of his beak to the bottom of his feet, he's covered in dirt and dust. She grabs Chippy. She runs down the hall. She gets into the bathroom and she turns on the water faucet. And she starts sticking Chippy under this water faucet. Now he's just being doused with this cold water. He's shivering. He's cold. So she does what any compassionate bird owner does. She grabs the hair dryer. She turns on the hair dryer, starts blowing Chippy dry. Now, in the theater of your mind, you get a picture for just a minute. Here's Chippy. He's just hanging out. He's having a good time. And all of a sudden, bam, he gets sucked into a vacuum cleaner, ran down a hall, doused with the cold water, blown with a hot hair dryer. Life can be like that sometimes, you know? Everything's fine. Everything's great. Things are going smooth, and all of a sudden, the phone call happens. The letter comes in the mail. The grades come out. I mean, something bad happens in the blink of an eye. And there's times in our lives we go through those tough times. And last year when I was here, I talked about God's promises. You know, that God doesn't only give explanations. He gives promises. And when you're going through a tough time, that God will always give you a promise. Now, I always said that, like I said last year, we all have problems in our lives. And you're always going to have a problem. I was speaking at a church in the U.S. and a lady walked up to me one time. She said, John, will you pray for me? I wouldn't have any more problems. I put my hands on her and said, God, kill her. No, I didn't. I wanted to. It's just a fact of life. As long as you're alive, as long as you're breathing, you're going to have problems. My friend Lowell Holkalter is here today, as you met him a little bit earlier. Lowell travels all over the United States, all over the world, speaking to young people. He does thousands and thousands of school assemblies. This is a man who has a huge heart. He's going to come and share with you for just a moment. But as a favor to me, he came to Israel because I love this country so much. And I asked him to come, him and his wife, Tammy. Would you give a big hand to my friend, Mr. Lowell Holkalter?
Thanks, John. I thought John was going to say, when I think about problems, I think about Lowell. But there are problems in life. There are things that happen. I've been thinking a lot about family. This is the first Thanksgiving that my wife and I have spent away from our four children. And so in this last week, we've been thinking about our family. We've been emailing back and forth, and our kids are trying out for sports teams, and we're trying to find out how they've done. And as we've toured around, I keep saying to myself, oh, my son would love to see that. Oh, my daughter would love to see that. And we can't help but think about family. And sometimes when we think about family, we think about problems. Sometimes when we think about the things that go around us, the things that happen in life, there's something usually you can tie back. Well, it was about 5 years ago, and my sister, who was a personal trainer, she's all fit, she's all skinny, she likes to lead people in exercise. I call her the fitness Nazi. I call her that because she has no compassion for anyone. No compassion. I mean, you could be in great shape, and she will always be in better shape. And she's just that way. Well, it was New Year's Eve, and we were spending it together at my parents' house. And she is my younger sister, and so in my mind, I'm better than her. So I wanted her to understand that, and I need to keep reminding her of that, that I am better than her. Now, my little sister looked over to me, and in her deepest compassion, she said to me, because she loves me and cares for me, she looked at me and she said, "You are really getting fat." And I didn't love her anymore. But my little sister was right. You see, I had let myself go. But I wasn't going to admit that. I said, I've maybe put on a few pounds, but I haven't lost anything. She said, "You know what?" She said, "Next September, I'm going to run a marathon." I said, "So?" She goes, "Do you understand? That's 26.2 miles. I go, "So?" She said, "You could never do it." And I said, "Are you kidding me? Who couldn't do that? Anyone could do that." And then she crossed the line. She did the unthinkable. She looked at me and she said these words, "I dare you." I said, "Not a problem. Not an issue." I said, "I'll take that challenge. I'll take that dare." She says, "All right, tomorrow's New Year's Day. Why don't we start tomorrow and begin to train for this marathon?" I said, "Not a problem." She said, "You need to take it easy." I said, "What are you talking about, take it easy? I'm ready to go. I'm ready to do it. I'm an athlete. I am sculpted. I'm in shape." And in deep inside of my mind, I'm going, "I'm going to die." The next morning came. I thought when she said morning, that meant when the sun came up. However, when she said morning, it meant sometime after midnight. So at about 4:30 in the morning, there was a knock on my door, and I heard her voice. No compassion, no love, no concern for what I thought and what I felt. She called me and she said, "It's time." And so I got out of bed and I began to put on clothes. Now, we were at my parents' house. They live in a city that is a mile high. It's New Year's Eve. It's about, well, it felt like about 500 degrees below zero. It was more like about 35 below zero with the wind chill factor. It was freezing cold. So I began to pack on clothes and clothes. I had gloves. I had a cap that covered up my ears. I mean, I looked three times my size by the time it was over, but I wanted to be warm. She said, "You better stretch out." I said, "I don't need to stretch out. I'm ready." She goes, "We're going to run 2 miles. I said, "That's it? Only 2 miles? I said, "Whatever. That's your choice." So we got outside. We stretched a little bit. She says, "I've already marked off the 2 miles. That didn't surprise me one bit. She probably got up an hour and a half earlier and ran it. But she marked off the 2 miles. She says, "We're going to run there and we'll turn around and run back." I thought to myself, 2 miles really is not that far. It's certainly not that far if you're getting in your car and driving to an ice cream shop. It's really not that far at all. So we got outside and we began to run. And just thinking about it right now makes me winded, because I began to run and we got a little ways and I was starting to get a little winded and I couldn't catch my breath, and we'd gone about 100 yards and I was really running out of breath, and she kept saying to me in that encouraging voice, "Come on, you're holding me back." And so I tried to speed up and it was icy, and with every step I took, I lost a half a step, and I was really getting tired. And now there was an uphill slope, and we began to run uphill, and I began to pray out to the Lord that He would just take my life and just end it all. But I continued to run, and pretty soon we'd gone maybe a quarter of a mile, and I realized that for the sake of health, I needed to walk. And so I began to walk, And she began in, once again, her loving, humble, compassionate way to run around me in circles because she certainly didn't want to slow down her progress. And so she would run around and would chant out in a rhythmic sort of tone that I was out of shape and that I was fat. And in that encouragement, I began to walk faster. And I walked, and we almost got to the mile point, and my lungs felt like they were about the size of a small coin. And I couldn't get a breath, and with every breath that I breathed in, I could hear this squeaking noise. And I thought for sure it was my heart shutting down. You know, the people that live inside of you that say, all right, shut it down. It's over. That's the way I felt. Well, I got to that mile mark. She had already gone to that mark and run back to get me. I decided at that point, it just didn't matter anymore. I laid down literally in the middle of the street. I was so thankful that it had snowed the night before and I could feel the cool snow on the side of my face as it brought me relief. And my sister, now moved by total compassion and care for me, her brother, her loving brother, the one that stuck up for her in her time of need, she got over the top of me and she leaned down. And in true compassion, I can still see the scene in my eyes. She said, get up! Just get up! You're embarrassing me! I didn't care. I just thanked the Lord for the cold snow that I could feel on my face. As she screamed and people were looking out of their windows, cars were driving on the street, and I didn't care. And I could only think back to Psalm 3, where the psalmist said, how my adversaries have increased. The only thing I wanted to do was just get enough strength to reach up and grab that little sister by the throat. I felt no compassion. But it was coming near September of the next year. And I had trained. I had begun. 2 miles for me was nothing anymore. 2 miles was really just a walk in the park for me. I had gotten to the point where I could run 17 or 18 miles in one shot. I had lost a lot of weight. Obviously, you're saying I've gained it back. I'll say it so you don't have to. But I had gotten my body to the point where I could run a long distance. And September was almost here. September, the day of the race was almost here. But something happened in my life that once again showed me that I could be like Chippy the Parakeet. Something happened in my life that totally rocked my world. You see, as I got up that morning to get ready for my run, I ran about 6 miles that day. We came home and it was Labor Day. And so it was the last big holiday of the summer and our family was together. And we were playing catch. I was playing catch with my little boy who was 9 years old with the baseball in the backyard. I threw the baseball to him. It was just a little bit too high for him to reach, and he jumped up to get it, and it was just too high, and it rolled on the grass behind him. He ran after that baseball, and he fell to the ground. Oh, I knew he liked to play jokes. I knew that was just his personality. He laid there, and I thought, well, I'll just wait him out. After he laid there for a long time, I said, come on, buddy, if we're going to play ball, get up and get the baseball, and let's play. That little boy replied back to me. He said, Dad, I can't get up. Dad, I can't get up. I can't feel my legs. Well, like any father, I looked at him. I said, buddy, you know we don't make jokes like that. That's not funny. Now get up and get the baseball and let's play. He said, Dad, I'm not joking. I'm serious. Dad, I'm serious. I'm scared. I ran up and I looked at that little boy. I said, what are you talking about, son? What do you mean? He said, Dad, I don't know. Dad, I was running after the baseball and I fell down and I can't feel anything in my legs, Dad. At that point again, I began to realize how my adversaries had increased. I picked up that little boy. We rushed him to the hospital. They did the very best they could. A specialist had agreed to look at that little boy. That next morning, they took him and they put him in an MRI machine that took pictures of the inside of his body. The doctor came out and he says, normally I wouldn't be able to tell you what's going on. He said, but just to give you a heads up, there's a large mass on your little boy's backbone. He said, there's a specialist that's willing to look at your little boy. And we took that boy in, now in a wheelchair, and we wheeled him into the small examination room, and the doctor came in. He took those MRI slides, and he put them up on the wall and turned the light on from behind. And he took out a pen from his pocket and he drew a circle. And he told us that there was a large mass the size of a cantaloupe that had grown on that little boy's back. It snapped his backbone in half and now leaned up against his spinal cord, which cut off all the brain waves all the way to the bottom of his feet. And I listened as that doctor said, "We've got two options." He said, "The first option is this. The first option is that we could take your little boy and we could wrap a brace around his body. We'd have to make some modifications on his body, but the quality of life may not be what it is now, but his mind will be there and your little boy will be alive." And then that doctor took his hands and he put them on his knees. And he looked at that little 9-year-old boy eye to eye. As I stood against that wall adjacent, as I watched that little boy who only days earlier had been running in the backyard, I again felt like there was this cloud over the top of me. When I didn't feel I could get up, when I didn't feel like anything could get any worse, I heard the words of that doctor when he said, "We could do an operation. We could try to remove that tumor. We could try to rebuild your backbone by placing metal titanium rods from the top of your back to the very bottom." He said, "But young man, I've got to be honest with you." He said, "If we begin to remove this tumor, there's a large chance, about 85% chance, that you'll begin to bleed and you'll bleed to death and there's nothing we could do about it. And you won't make it out of that operating room alive." And I stood against that wall and I thought to myself, things like this don't happen to me. Things like this happen to other people. Things like this happen to people that when the man stands up behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning and says, "Who's got a prayer request?" And someone says that they know somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody. Things like that don't happen to me. They certainly don't happen in my family. And now I found myself in a situation where it felt like my adversaries had increased again. But I watched a little boy as he looked at that doctor. And he said, "Sir, I want you to take it out. I want you to take it out." And there was fear that struck into my heart. I watched my wife as her hands caught her face as she dropped her head into her hands as she began to sob. I watched that little boy take his wheelchair and wheel it over. And with his eyes as dry as could be, he put his arm on the back of his mother and said, "Don't cry, Mom. Don't cry. Everything's going to be okay." And I wanted to get in the face of that little boy and said, "No, it won't be okay. Did you hear what he just said? The odds are not in your favor. There's not a very good chance. Did you hear what he just said?" But I watched a little boy who began to rise up in faith, who began to understand that even though your adversaries increase, there is one who promises to be a shield about us and to be the lifter of our head. September 15th, the day of his operation came. A lot of people had come to wish him well. We prayed together as we held hands around his bed, but they were all gone. It was just my little boy and my wife and I. As the doctor walked in and he grabbed my hand, he says, "We'll do the best we can with your little boy." I pulled that doctor close so only he could hear my voice. I said, "Sir, that's not good enough for me. That's not good enough for me. That's my little boy." And he pulled away. And loud enough for everyone in the room to hear, he said, "Sir, I told you that there were no promises and no guarantees. All I can tell you is we'll do our very best." And he let go of my hand and he walked out. The nurse came in and she said, "It's time." You see, I had felt like Chippy the parakeet. I had felt like my life had been totally turned upside down in a matter of 4 days. One moment playing catch with my little boy in the backyard, now watching as the nurse began to push him down into an operating room. I stood there, holding my wife as we began to weep. We had done our very best not to cry in front of that little boy, because something inside of him was telling him that everything would be all right. Maybe he believed the stories that he heard in Sunday school. Maybe he believed that when we gathered around the table in the evenings and we talked about how Jesus had done things in the scriptures and how people that we knew had been healed. Maybe he honestly believed those things. And maybe he believed that God, who sent his son Jesus Christ, if that same God could do it then, something inside of him said he could do it now. And they wheeled him down this hallway. And all of a sudden, his arm came up off the table. And I could hear his voice say, "Stop! Would you just stop?" And the nurse stopped that bed from moving. "Dad, are you still there? Dad, are you still back there? Dad, please." "Yeah, we're still here." "Yeah, son, I'm right here. Could you come here just one more time? One more time, Dad." And I thought to myself, this is the moment. This is the moment that they'd all say, that they had all said that when it really came down to it, he would lose faith and he would give up and he would take the easy way out. I dried my eyes the best I could, put on my brave face, and I walked up and I looked down into the face of my 9-year-old son. And this man of faith became a man of doubt. And my true colors showed as I began to weep, as I looked down into the eyes of that little boy. And as this boy looked down in the eyes of a man at 9 years old who understood that there was a God who lifted his head. He reached up his arm and he put it around me and he pulled me close. He put his lips right next to my ears. And he said, "Dad, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, Dad. Everything is going to be all right." Oh, how I wanted to believe that. I so desperately wanted to believe that. And he kissed me on the cheek, and they wheeled him away. The doctor said it would be 8.5 hours he'd be in that operation. I couldn't find any place where no one was in that hospital, except for a restroom down a long hallway that I could lock the door behind me. And I got on my face in that filthy restroom, and I began to cry out to God. I began to cry out and say, "God, this is not fair. God, I don't like how this makes me feel." And it was at that moment I heard the voice of God say, "This isn't about you. It's not about you. It's about what I have planned in the life of your little boy. You see, there is a plan. There is a purpose for our lives. And if anyone knows it, it's the Creator Himself, the one who gave us life." And I stood up and I asked forgiveness, but I asked for strength. I walked out of that restroom, and 8.5 hours later, the doctor came out of that operating room and he stood in front of my wife and myself. He reached up and he pulled the mask down from his face. And he said, just moments ago in the operating room, your little boy, for the very first time, he lifted his legs up off the table and he wiggled his toes. I can't tell you how that made me feel. I did think I was going to lose my wife to another man that day when she jumped into the arms of that doctor, kissing and hugging him. That doctor was a little bit uncomfortable when I followed suit and did the same thing. But you see, I didn't care. It wasn't more than about a month ago, and I stood at a starting line of a race that my little boy ran. Now 14 years old, and my mind raced back all the way to when it all started. And that little sister of mine looked at me and said, "Get up! Get up!" And as life progressed and I watched a little boy, when everybody around him said he'd never walk, he'd never run, I heard the gun sound and he began to run. And all the parents that were there and all the fans began to cheer. But I began to weep as I began to think that no matter the adversaries, no matter what happens to us, there is a man named Jesus Christ who came from God the Father. And when the psalmist faced his adversaries, he understood that there was a God who was a shield about him, that no matter what took place, everything would be okay. Everything would be taken care of. I don't know what you battle with today. I don't know your struggle. I don't know the individuals that rise above you, that taunt you. I don't know what the enemy has brought your direction. The thoughts of failure, the thoughts of worry, the thoughts of doubt. But today I'm here to tell you to get up. Don't just lay there. Get up and allow God to do something great in your life. As John comes, my encouragement to you today is this. No matter what takes place around you, He is the shield about you, and He is the lifter of your head.
This morning, as we wrap this up, can you turn the mic up just a little bit more? As we wrap up our time here this morning, I want to say thank you, Lil and Tammy, for coming. But maybe you are here today, and you're going through a tough time. And maybe you came here this morning, and the pressures of life, family, I don't know, work. I don't know what brought you here. But maybe you're here, and you're tired. You just need someone to hold your head. Like Lowell said so eloquently, God will do that for you. He'll be with you every step of the way. So many times I've stood here and I've told you about the little boy who couldn't talk. And everyone made fun of that little boy. How he got took out of school, put with kids who were mentally handicapped. How everyone made fun of him. How he got kicked out of the public school system. The only place that would take him was a Christian school. Not being around Christians his whole entire life. He walked out the first day of school. His mom turning to him and saying, sweetie, this school's going to be different. They're going to be nice to you. It's a Christian school. That morning he walked out to lunch. Put his lunch down the table. And the first words that anyone said to him was, what are you doing? We want you to eat lunch with us. You're retarded. Go by yourself. Little boy, like always, walked over. Ate lunch by himself. But the little boy never gave up. Like Carson, their son. He became a young man and went to college. The only place to accept him was on academic probation. And before he went to college, a man he respected, a man he looked up to, walked over to him and said, you'll never make it. I can't understand you right now. Those words devastated him, but he didn't give up. He went on to school. He would go to class, come back to his room and just cry because he felt so dumb. He went on to hit the dean's list and graduate from college. Walking across the stage, graduation day. Cap and gown. He got his degree in his hands. And he realized he conquered the walls that people put into his life. Several times I shared that story here. And I told you how that little boy, how that young man went on. And today, that young man is me. And that's my story. Not a lot of people saw potential in my life. Not a lot of people were there for me. And that's why I listen to that story of Carson. And I thank God for Lil and Tammy that were there supporting their son. But there's some people here today. Maybe you don't have that support system. Maybe you're here, you're in Israel. You're by yourself. There's a God in heaven who'll be with you today. You're not alone. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes all over the room this morning? Oh God, I ask that you would touch every single person at the sound of my voice. God, let them know that you love them. Let them know that you believe in them. Oh God, we worship you.
I seek you, the more I find you, the more I find you, the more I love you. I want to sit at your feet, drink from the cup in your hand, lay back against you and breathe, feel your heartbeat. This love is so deep, it's more than I can stand. I melt in your peace. It's overwhelming.
This morning, with your heads bowed, your eyes closed, just 1 second before we dismiss, before we go and have lunch, Rhonda, would you sing that song one more time? To see it one more time.
The more I seek you, the more I find you. The more I find you, the more I love you. I want to sit at your feet, drink from the cup in your hand, lay back against you and breathe, and feel your heartbeat. This love is so deep, it's more than I can stand. I melt in your peace, it's overwhelming.
This morning, with no one looking, with your heads bowed, your eyes closed, all over this room, I'm not going to stand you. I'm not going to call you for it. I'm not going to embarrass you. But right where you're at, I just feel this in my heart for the sake of time this morning. You're here. You love God. But maybe you're going through a tough time. Maybe you feel like your life's been turned upside down. Maybe you're here today and things aren't making sense. And you just need God to wrap his arms of love around you this morning. You just need God to hold your head, to give you some strength, to whisper some weird words of encouragement into your ears. If that's you, right where you're at, with no one looking, would you just put your hand in the air and put it right back down and say, John, include me in your prayer this morning. Slip it up so I can see it. God bless you. 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 Oh God. Oh God. Oh Jesus. Would you say it one more time? Oh
God. The more I seek you, the more I find you. The more I find you, the more I love you. The more I seek you, the more I find you. The more I find you, the more I love you.
Dear Lord, we come to you today. Some of us broken and hurt. Some of us at one of the lowest times of our life, not understanding why we're in the situation, why we're in the circumstance. We cry out in our own flesh how our adversaries have increased, how my problems have gotten bigger, how much more impossible it seems around me. How much darker the night has gotten. How much lonelier I feel. I thank you, first of all, Lord, that you allow us to be the people that you've created us to be. You don't condemn us for questioning. But I thank you, Lord, that in the midst of the dark, you allow your light to shine. your light of hope. Even though we don't understand when James says to give thanks for the testings and the trials, we don't understand that. We don't like these times. But by faith and out of obedience, we say thank you. Thank you because we understand it's not about us, but it's about the plan that you have for our life. It's about what you want to accomplish around us. It's about the individuals whose lives will be changed because they've watched us as we've been knocked down and we get back up and we move forward. And as a testimony to your greatness, as a testimony to your faithfulness, and a testimony of your grace and your mercy in our life, there will be many that will come to know you. So by your Spirit today, we ask, Lord, that you would touch those who find themselves knocked down, beaten down, suppressed, and lonely. Be that shield to them today, O God. Be their glory, and be the one that reaches down and picks up their head and lifts it just one more time. Thank you for the peace that passes all of our human understanding. We thank you today, Lord, that you care about us. Thank you that you care about each one who raised their hand. You've known the situation before it even began, and you know how it will end before it even ends. We ask for strength as we move through the times of trial and testing, but we give you thanks. Thanks for the plan that will be accomplished in our life.